Specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassinations, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media.
Chuck O'Kelly!
29th day of December 2017, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. This indeed is the O'Kelly Effect, broadcast live from the facilities of O'Kelly.com, also heard on various affiliate networks and replayed in many places. So good evening to you, whether you're hearing us live or you're catching us via your Fondle Slab of choice, your applicable application, etc., etc. It is a Friar's Day, as they used to call it, a Friday night, and I'm doing something completely different. Now, some people are going to say, no, you're not. No, you're not at all, because you talk about the JFK assassination a lot. And with my guest, Alan Dale, tonight, I guarantee you the JFK assassination is going to come up in the conversation. But I plan to take this in my normal, unscripted, unchoreographed direction, as per usual. We're going to, I do believe, have a bit of fun and hear a great deal of contrast between, well, let's just say two diverse personalities here tonight. First one being mine, as per usual, you know, obviously it's the O'Kelly Effect at O'Kelly.com. Duh. But, you know, it is what it is. Alan Dale is a guy who I only physically met recently at the JFK Lancer Conference. However, I've encountered his work in several places, including at JFKConversations.com. I have heard about Alan, and I have heard some of the things he said. I have listened to a lot of what Alan has said. I find him to be one of the most fascinating and riveting voices actually out there speaking about the JFK assassination. Now, one might say, is that because of his depth of research? One might say, is that about some particular discovery that Alan made? No, it's just because Alan is Alan. Anyway, so how you doing tonight, my friend?
Happy to be here.
You know, and you're going to be the last JFK sort of oriented guest, although, again, I plan to get into some other conversations with you tonight that will not touch upon that subject. But, you know, it is interesting because you and I do have distinctly different personalities, and the way that each one of us has a presence in a room, I found that to be one of the most unique dynamics. And at the same time, I promise you this, the next time we are in the same city together, we will have to drink until one of us is blind. Well, wait a minute.
Uh-oh. Too late.
Too late.
That's a good idea. I'm sorry we didn't get to hang out more at the Lancer conference. We each had our respective responsibilities. And I was happy and grateful to have the opportunity to meet you and speak with you to the extent that we did.
Well, look, and I appreciate it as well. Now, you were there as the MC, but also as an assistant to John Newman, who we've discussed at, you know, at length on this show, and also had us on as a guest. And he is one of the most interesting guys when it comes to the deep, deep pool of the research out there, for sure. The bulk of information that John Newman is responsible for presenting to the public is amazing, but we're not here to talk about him tonight. I want to talk about you and a couple of common links between us, which we don't sound as though we have common links. And I love the portion from which I pulled the last time you were on this show as part of a Myths episode to bring into this little film that we did recently called JFK O'Kelly on the Grassy Knoll. I don't know if you watched the portion that you were in there, but I'm amazed at your ability to be an orator seemingly in almost any circumstance, whether you're at a podium, a microphone, a telephone, or, hey, standing in the dark almost in a hotel bar area talking to me personally one way or another. You have this very erudite sort of air to you, but you're also a musician, an interesting one, too. How is it that you know, if nobody, if somebody was listening right now, I should say, who has never heard of you before, has no idea who I'm talking to, how is it that you would introduce yourself to someone hearing your voice for the first time?
I would say that in across a great number of years, really all of the years of my life to date, I've had improbable good fortune and blessings and privileges, which might seem to have manifested themselves in ways which are dissimilar. But the older I am and the more I reflect upon things which are difficult to reflect upon as they're happening, it's very hard to be objective about your own story. That's true of absolutely everybody. But when I was a child, I had great privileges because my dad was a very experienced musician. First time he worked in Las Vegas was for 5 months in 1947. And he became well acquainted with legendary people that became like family to me. And I had I started playing drums when I was five for real, when I was playing 5 years when I was 5 years old. Up until then, I was just playing on hat boxes using cardboard tubes from disassembled hangers. But I traveled very, very extensively throughout the United States with Louie Belson and Buddy Rich. And Pearl Bailey was my Aunt Pearl. And I had very privileged interaction with legendary jazz musicians, including Ella Fitzgerald and lots of other people whom I revered. And because of my relationship with Louie and Buddy Rich, I think I had something sort of built in which prepared me for a completely different arena. And the completely different arena did not emerge for me as an adult until within the last 10 years. And I do, as you mentioned, I have the privilege of being an administrative and research assistant to a person of some very serious stature and ultimate credentials relevant to our mutual interests, Dr. John Newman. And I serve one of our ultimate heroic Freedom of Information Act attorneys, Jim Lazar, who's the president of the Assassination Archives and Research Center. And I work extensively on behalf of and in the company of one of a small number of the world's leading authorities on the interior systems management, the infrastructure of the intelligence agencies during the Cold War, a truly great and generous and extraordinary man named Malcolm Blunt. I'd say something like that.
Right. And yet again, this does not fully describe Alan Dale. Just to tell you guys, I mean, yes, indeed, I didn't include all of that in the description for you, but it is part of the story for sure. Now, I'm extremely interested during this portion of the conversation in your development before these 10 years as of late, because it definitely formed your personality. I mean, being around these great musicians, I mean, who does not know who Buddy Rich is? Who does not know who Ella Fitzgerald is? Okay. Who was your dad, though? Because that I was never clear on. The only guy named Dale I ever recall, you know, as a music historian of sorts, right, is Dick Dale, who was an interesting musician, and I liked his stuff.
Had a big hit. Know? I heard all about that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you did. I mean, obviously, the last name being in common there, I'm sure you've heard it before. But and if people who are listening don't know who Dick Dale is, look it up, please. But anyway.
Go to YouTube.
Go to YouTube. You'll find it.
My dad was a Society Vibes vibraphone. That's the instrument that Lionel Hampton, Red Norvo, and small number of other people, Gary Burton, Terry Gibbs, made famous during the early years of the swing era, Lionel Hampton being kind of the ultimate example of a great vibraphonist. It's a 3-octave metallic keyboard, horizontal keyboard played with mallets, and he was a society bass player and violinist who, among his interesting stories, included playing society gigs with both Larry Fine, who was one of the Three Stooges and a professional violinist to some extent, and George Liberace. Now, if that's not an indirect claim to fame, I don't know what is. But he was a society dance band musician. His name was Billy Dale, and he started working as a child. He got his first paid gig, Chuck, playing for Franklin Roosevelt on the steps of the Pennsylvania Capitol building in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, sometime around the very beginning of President Roosevelt's first term in office. And he played banjo. So his grandfather gave him his violin, which was an 1888 German copy of a Guarnerius. And he began playing violin when he was 7 years old, and apparently took his violin, his one and only treasured possession, with him during World War II, where it stayed on their B-29 for 2 years. And the result of which is that the name painted underneath my father's bubble — he was a bubble gunner with control over two different gun turrets. The master gunner determined which one the guys sitting in the bubbles would operate. He had the word maestro painted under his bubble, and I've got many photographs of their plane in Tinian and Saipan and Guam with my dad's bubble and the word maestro painted underneath. So I grew up on the road. My dad was a musician during the era where professional society dance band musicians worked 7 nights a week, and so that was the life that I knew. Extensive traveling, only in place for 6 weeks when I was born, and then on the road thereafter. My dad was working a job at the Broadmoor, famous huge legendary place in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And almost immediately thereafter, became aware of a young senator from Massachusetts who was seeking the Democratic nomination of his party, you know, the nomination of his party to run as president of the United States. And my mom was holding me as a newborn when she encountered JFK prior to the presidential election, actually prior to him even winning the nomination. Where my mom and dad knew that JFK was making a campaign appearance, would be speaking at a podium outdoors. I believe it was in Michigan, although I'm really not positive where it took place. But I believe I was told that it happened somewhere in Michigan, which is, you know, Gerald Ford country, not exactly Kennedy country, but he had an enthusiastic reception. And what my dad remembered was he'd never seen anybody so tanned or so handsome in his life. And my mom found a place at the front of the rope. And my first experience being given special treatment, you know, VIP treatment, was that JFK came up one side of the podium to speak, and then spoke and exited the opposite side of the podium, at which point everybody behind my mom pressed forward to get close to him, to shake hands with him, which is a natural scene when somebody's working the ropes, working the crowd. Only nobody else could see that she was holding a small child, a little baby, and that was me. JFK saw it, and according to my mom, and I have reason to believe that she did not make this up, it was one of the happiest experiences of her life. It meant more to her than I could possibly relay, that she heard him say, "Watch out for the lady with the baby," because apparently she looked panicked because all of a sudden she's getting jostled and she's got a little baby nobody behind her could see, as a result of which one of his aides lifts the rope, and on the other side of the rope, the protected side, with JFK. Now, my mom and I were, much to the delight of my father, I'm sure. you know, who didn't make the cut, but we did. And as I said in Dallas, that was the birth of my sense of, you know, entitlement.
Which, by the way, during the awards that were given out there, I followed you and looked over at you sitting next to me when I went up to the podium to say thank you, and said, "Oh, gee, is that all it took to get there, Alan? That's amazing."
Yeah, that's all it took. There you go. Apparently, it doesn't take much, huh?
Well, look, that's a remarkable experience, and one that not too many people can lay claim to, I guarantee. So, you know, it is unique. I'm joking with you, obviously. This is, you know, I mean, I'm kind of breaking your chops a little bit, but
it's fine.
But you have that kind of sense of humor, which, you know, you sound like a very serious man all the time. A lot of, you know, when you're doing these conversations, these interviews, you're very serious about the work that you do for Mr. Lazar, obviously, for Dr. Newman, you know, for Malcolm Blunt, who is, by the way, out of the three of them, probably the guy whose name is heard the least. Yeah. Out there, and I think people should not forget Malcolm Blunt, who, by the way, had an interesting interaction with not too long ago. Interesting guy, one of the most intelligent men out there who has ever studied the case, in my estimation, just based on my observations, and somebody that, yes, indeed, if you're interested in the JFK assassination, I strongly advise, when you do your searches, look at what Malcolm Blunt has to say about quite a few things.
Chuck, I just want to say to you that one of the things, as I gradually became aware of you and Carmine and, you know, a couple of other people, not too many, as you're well aware, I do not have an enormous amount of recreational time, and that's not jive. There aren't enough hours in the day for me to listen to absolutely everything. I'm supposed to read everything and to be aware of everything. And having done that now, it's you know, I mean, it's a constant battle of being overwhelmed with new materials and having old projects on your platter and all of that. But the fact that you just made that observation really connects with me in my heart, because I recognize that without somebody like me saying to you, hey, there's a guy named Malcolm Blunt that is one of our ultimate resources, who is arguably the most knowledgeable person about the records held at the National Archives for the last 19 years or so, and who is arguably the most influential person you've never heard of in the JFK case, for you to have already come to a place where you understand that. I don't want to get all gushy on you, but I'm going to tell you in all sincerity that it just makes me admire you even more. And the fact that nobody is handing you anything on a silver platter is not lost on me. So for you to have arrived at a place, you know, it's all a work in progress for all of us, myself most of all, from my perspective. But even for figures like Dr. Newman and Malcolm and Bill Simpich, we are all engaged in this as a work in progress. And for you to have come to this realization without somebody literally just putting their arm around you and taking you under their wing and enjoying some of the privileges which I enjoy, I take very seriously what you have already achieved in your own life. And I think that it is admirable that you have chosen to do what you do, to share the realizations and the perspective that you've earned.
Well, I do thank you for that. A little bit of an unfair advantage, because I spent a lot of time friendly with Joan Mellon, you see. And I've got to tell you that almost every conversation with Joan, I would say in the past 10 years, you know, when we talk about what's being discovered and how to look at these things, and the Malcolm comes up, yeah. You see. So, you know, this is I'm getting guidance sometimes, and it's only for brief periods of time. Walt Brown has been extremely influential to me as well. In the past, I have not been in contact with him recently, but in the past, you know, I spent time with him. I used to go to his house and go for the November in what was it? Now wait a minute, the Dallas in I forget what they would call it, but there was like a gathering at Walt's house around the anniversary when he wasn't going to a conference.
Yeah,
and I used to go to those, you know, and stuff like that. So I mean, I've actually been around a little longer than some people ever seem to remember.
Yeah.
And it's because I was sort of out of place for a long time. I looked the part of being that heavy metal musician guy. And I would walk into a room with a high school diploma, by the way, under my belt, basically. I would walk into a room with PhDs, you know, and other interesting people who had really put in a lot of work very early on. I just got involved in these circles because I wasn't here's the truth of it. I wasn't afraid to go to a prison, say, and, you know, go through the process of getting myself on a visiting list and sitting down with a legitimate mafia figure who you might never have heard of, or maybe some that you have heard of. Right. To get information, to discuss certain things about criminal activities that might be related to this case. Because of my background, this was not a big deal to me. But it was the kind of thing that set me into a strange place, you see. Okay.
Well, I'm interested in hearing that you have indeed had mentors, and isn't it something to have the privilege of having mentors who are rational and disciplined and who are not egomaniacs who simply want followers to believe or to accept that every word that they say is gospel, and that's all you need to know. So, you know, I think that having the right mentors is the blessing to which you and I would, you know, aspire.
Well, absolutely. And you know, there's other guys, too, that like Roger Remington, who is another name most people have never heard of. But he indeed wrote 4 books on the case. And I haven't spoken to him in a while. But this is a historian, you know, professor from Aquinas College. Interesting guy. He wrote Biting the Elephant, I think, is the only thing that anybody's ever actually paid attention to. Of course, it is based on the general African proverb about how is it that you consume an elephant one bite at a time. Well, you know, and this is about the case, you see, because it becomes so enormous. And the files and the research and the different figures you could speak to. And I've told the story several times on here, too, that while I was traveling as a musician, I would be in certain cities where I was just vaguely aware that somebody might live here who I've read about in a book, and take out that old thing they used to call a phone book and flip through it and see if I could find a name sometimes. And I would make cold calls. Mm-hmm. And just try to have conversations with people. Later on, of course, I would start taping them. But initially, this is how I started speaking to witnesses. This is how, and it just sort of, I don't know, snowballed into me going from, you know, being the later teenage yeared, you know, heavy metal musician into my adulthood. And going in, you know, to the National Archives and actually going through other people's files and examining photographs and trying to do work on, which is a strange thing for a guy who's, you know, basically blind to do. But nevertheless, I did all of that. And, you know, this is how it all came together. I can't say per se that anybody was my mentor, but I definitely paid attention to those people that were
good
rational.
Example. Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Rational, that they were, you know, great students of not only the case, but of the context that the case was in. To me, this is one of the most important, also underused words, the context of everything. You know, often I observe the idea that people say that John F. Kennedy was this liberal figure that the right wing wanted to destroy. Okay, it depends on what time period you're using the word liberal, okay, as to how liberal he was, et cetera, right? And you have to put it into its proper context. Everything must be placed into its proper context. With that in mind, I throw a small tidbit at you that I observed when I was leaving Dallas. because we had been discussing a lot of things. Obviously, we're at the Lancer Conference, and all sorts of discussions had gone on about new information, old information, what's good about it, what's bad about it, what's actually happening, what are people going to do with it? Okay. I'm leaving Dallas, walking to the Greyhound station, you know, with my suitcase on wheels dragging behind me. And about a block away, or maybe a block and a half away from the Greyhound station, I notice that I'm in front of a building that doesn't quite fit in with the architecture around me. And I'm vaguely aware of these things, you know, the aesthetics. I might not have a full grasp of them because of my vision, but I do notice this building is a little out of place. And I look up to my left, and do you know what I saw, Alan?
What did you see?
The Cabell Federal Building.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So, you know, and like that just started me on a trail, you know, back through all the conversations we had just had,
yeah.
The recent revelations of the documents, all of that stuff going on, you know, all of this has been a tremendous work in progress that I kind of started in the late 80s. And again, without even a proper toolbox for doing the work that would be researched later, with just a curiosity in hand and a determination to learn. So, you know, in this way, this is why there's a lot of quirks in some of the ways that I explain things and do things. I am not a standard scholar or academic in any way, shape, or form.
Well, I'd like to ask you a question, Chuck. I mean, it's your show. The role is reversed for me for once, and I'm willing to acknowledge that. But I have a question. Can I ask you something?
Always.
My question is this. If someone were to say to you that one of the most important things about what all of us are engaged in, or at least most of us, is to, which requires the investment of so much time, so much effort, no easy solutions, no here's the answer on a silver platter, real work, real scholarship, real scrutiny of various materials, not least of which would be, unfortunately, all of the books which about which I referred in conversation with the great Professor Peter Dale Scott recently, and he laughed when I said some of the books are less harmful than others. My question to you is, by what means can you communicate to someone who is new to all of this how to differentiate between what's real and what isn't, or what's important and what isn't? How do you begin to express to somebody that it's not just that there's a lot of stuff that has happened, that has been produced, that's relevant to where we are 54 years later? The question is, how can you explain to somebody the process by which you get to a point where you can differentiate between what's true and what isn't?
You know, that is rather difficult to describe. And first, I must admit a handicap here that, you know, among the literary works that are focused on the case, I'm at last count, I think I was a little over 300 books that I've read. Now, that sounds like a lot, but, you know, in its proper perspective, many years ago, there were over 1,000. So, you know, and that's standard mainstream publications. I mean, we're not even talking about the monographs and the independent stuff and the
Good
things
point.
That were, you know.
Good point. Yeah.
So the thing is, I'm at a bit of a disadvantage because I don't have the whole of the literature read. I know no one that I believe if they say they have read all of the documents. Okay. And I do mean no one. It's virtually impossible, which, by the way, is something I want to bring up with you in a very specific way shortly. And I've actually got an article that I want to read some excerpts from to get your reactions, because it was published today. It's, well, I have my feelings about it. I'll leave that for later, but I want to read a couple of excerpts from it in a little bit. The thing about your question though, Alan, is that it is very difficult to get someone to engage about what is truly important here, because what I've observed over the years is this: there is almost a Rorschach test effect to the JFK assassination. And this sounds like I'm ducking the question. I'm not. How it is important, what its context really is, varies from person to person. See, for me, the importance is that the country in which I live, the society in which I live, was damaged by it. Not because we stopped trusting our government. I mean, that we needed to do. Not because one man was killed. I know a murder is a terrible thing, but in the grand scheme of things, one man was killed. Not the end of the world. Presidents will come and go even. But the fact that what I understand about the Vietnam War resulting from that and the personal effect I know that had on my generation as the children of the men who served there, and the effect that I learned later it had on the Vietnamese, the effect that I believe it continues to echo with throughout the world, is worthy of making sure that we examine this and make sure that no one else who is making a decision that could avoid the disaster that keeps on giving, which to me is what the Vietnam War is, a criminal act and a disaster that keeps on giving. Okay. There is no reason in the world that we should not solve this and figure out how to stop things like this from happening, because in my estimation, they're still happening. And they're even more cloaked than they were then. But if we can unravel this, we can put a stop to a lot of damage in the very near future. Yeah. And the sooner we do it, the better. So that's my lens, though.
Yeah. Well, certainly with regard to your observation that this is something where every single person has their own version of it. And so in a way, what you're saying, if I understand it correctly, and it's always possible I don't, is that how you think, what you bring to this subject, will be relevant in terms of what you get out of it. So, you know, mm-hmm. with regard to thinking about whether the whole story exists within Dealey Plaza, which is a familiar kind of way of framing it, or if your focus is on the CIA and you're very insistent that the CIA killed President Kennedy, or if your focus is on the mafia or Fidel Castro or whatever is the explanation for people like Philip Shinnon and Larry Sabato and the authorized Robargian declaration that, yes, there was a cover-up, but it was benign. Because Lord knows we wouldn't want to have to deal with the fact, as they want us to believe, that Fidel was kind of responsible or that the Kremlin was kind of involved. My take on it in all sincerity is has always been that this is a religion. And so if you've ever looked into the origins, let's just say, of Christianity, it's a very interesting subject. Lots of different sects, none of whom are very tolerant of each other. And in the meantime, absolutely everybody able to declare that their faith is unique and that their understanding or their personal relationship with God is unique. So in some ways, I think the issue about the personality of who is approaching this subject for the first time, as important and as relevant that as that is, that's not necessarily the way the story is ultimately going to be represented in the future. It certainly is the story to date. Very passionate people who believe something, whether it's that Lyndon Johnson was, you know, responsible for some guy named Mack Wallace who was responsible, or, you know, an ultimate Nazi commando or whatever. We're interested in evidence. And I think that the period that we're living through, that is measurable through our lifetime, I've been here probably about the same amount of time that you've been here. And I'm at this point in my journey. And it's a journey that began with the terrible news that shots had been fired at President Kennedy's motorcade. But eventually, all of that hysteria and passion and what I have represented to some of the people with whom I share certain responsibilities as love and grief, loving the guy and grieving over his death, that will all be gone eventually. And at that point, what will be left might be the subject of very serious scrutiny by disciplined scholars who are trained in critical thinking.
Mm. Well, you know, very true. And you do understand my point. And it is, I believe, extremely valid that I often have noted people getting into this, bringing their own perspective in and almost
baggage. Bias.
Yeah,
exactly.
And I was just perfectly honest with you about mine. Now, I could tell you the quick backstory in about 60 seconds as to why that's relevant to me. You talked about your dad. He's a musician.
Yep.
My father served in Vietnam. And, you know, there's a lot of damage that was done there to the man that that I only knew up until the age of four, because that's when he died. Now, there's that. And there is what I observed growing up from other kids whose fathers had served, whose uncles had served, whose grandfathers had served. I found it to be a cancerous thing on our society in general, that conflict that, in my estimation, achieved nothing, okay, except to justify murder. It literally shapes my anti-war posture today as a full-grown male. I'm a little younger than you, but nevertheless, I mean, I was born in 1972, okay? So this is why it is personal to me. Not only that, but when I went to apply for help to go to college, figuring that since I was handicapped in a very technical and literal way, and also my father had served, that the government might offer me some assistance to go to college. I was not only greeted with, there is no record of your father having served, but I was also greeted with an explanation that I could be prosecuted for making such a false claim. This angered me. And introduced me to the idea that not only would my government either make a mistake, but they might lie to me and threaten me even. And what that did was, well, it made me give up on the idea of college. And that was okay because I was a musician anyway. But it angered me and has ever after motivated my desire to have this come to light in a much better way. Now, a postscript to that story, just so you know, is that in 2007, apparently, when they were moving some military records from the Vietnam era, my father's military record reappeared. But of course, this is 25 years after I had made the claim. So,
did you say 2007?
Correct.
And what was the explanation about whatever was put into motion during that era? Why was that? Why did that happen at that particular time? Do we have any explanation?
Well, believe this or not, it is Carmine Sabastano who actually discovered the record for me in 2014.
Oh, yeah,
because I had given up on finding it. And he said, well, give me the information and I'll go look. And I said, look, man, I've been looking since 1990 and I gave up a few years ago. It's not there. And I have photographs and I have, you know, things that I could probably take to court if I knew how. But I don't know. And I'm not going to because I don't believe they're going to have it. Anyway, he discovered it. And best I can piece together so far is that they were digitizing records is the only reason why. And this piece of paper was just there. It was there.
Yeah, that's really great. And God bless Carmine. I'm just curious if you have any information about the nature of your father's service, where, you know, to what he may have been assigned. and yes. whether there may have been a plausible explanation, even though we might not have enough to make any ultimate conclusions, I'm aware of cases of people who had particular types of assignments which would probably not have been shared with members of their family.
Right. Well, guess what? You've actually struck the correct note again. Here's what I discovered. Now, according to the official record currently, he went in and was discharged on a date, which, by the way, is impossible. And all of that, part of this record is clearly fabricated. The other thing is that I have him photographed and also have the accounts of someone who served with him that he was recruited rather quickly as a special forces sniper. And the thing is, it was because of a proficiency shown with a weapon during basic training that was so exceptional that they thought his talents would be better served there. And that is what happened to him. However, his official record now does not show this.
How interesting. Thank God for Carmine. And I'm very glad if this helps you have a better sense. Ultimate closure may never be available, but I suspect that this has moved you somewhere down the path of your own, you know.
It certainly did, Alan. Yeah. It certainly did, and I certainly don't want to make myself the focus of this tonight. No, but I think this is an interesting conversation, and it is relevant. Why? Because I'm sorry to say, folks, it's not unique. There are a lot of instances where individuals had special operations or special forces training where their records do not reflect it. Their records disappeared. Their records disappeared for a time period. Et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And it is, it fits right. I could write a conspiracy theory based on this, without a problem.
Chuck, tell me if you're familiar with a book called Expendable Elite, Expendable Elite by a guy named Dan, what the hell is that guy's name? Marvin. Dan Marvin,
Dangerous, you know. Dan Marvin.
Yes. You know about this? That's exactly the guy.
Yes, I do.
Expendable Elite. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I am aware of that. I'm not entirely clear. I mean, he's the guy who has the claims about Pitzer and Bethesda, and having been his general story was related first that he had been approached to actually assassinate a U.S. serviceman on U.S. soil. And if people want to look that up, yes, indeed, Dan Marvin is an interesting character and has been filmed and recorded in several places. You could probably find various presentations that have him as part of it out there on the internet, if you like. Just for the audience's sake, Alan, you and I both know who we're talking about. But
it's an interesting representation. I have someone who knew him personally in the field, whose name I cannot reveal. It sounds silly, but I feel most comfortable dealing with it like that. And so what I can tell you is that at least with regard to my perception of the book, there is some extremely authentic flavor to the perspective. And this is relevant to big picture JFK stuff, the perspective of people in the field. I looked this up just now. The subtitle to Expendable Elite is One Soldier's Journey into Covert Warfare. And something that I've learned over a period of years, and to which I referred in conversation with Malcolm Blunt during a presentation at the Dallas conference, is that it's not uncommon for the people in the field to think that the people at headquarters are stupid and that the people in the field know how to get things done. And there may be no representation officially. There may be no records, soft files, or any other kinds of files which might actually accurately depict the way a story actually, an event rather, took place. And so if you want a little flavor of that, I think this
this Dan Marvin book is worth looking at a little bit.
No, certainly. And, you know, we are down to the less than last 15 minutes here of this hour. We've actually gone 45 minutes in this conversation without really knowing it. Seems like to me, I don't know, time flies, especially when the company is good. And it certainly is. Alan Dale is with me, you know, for the listener's edification. Here it is. We're having kind of a private conversation here in public.
That's good. That's,
But I appreciate this, and I wanted to get to know, you know, you a little more in this hour, because we don't often hear these things. You know, I mean, you've been on a couple of other radio shows and podcasts and things where I've heard you discuss, you know, rather eloquently a great many subjects, but not so often yourself, which is why I wanted to do this a little bit differently tonight. In the second hour, I certainly want to get into the current state of affairs regarding the Kennedy assassination and where things are. You are uniquely positioned among the best of the best, the guys who are really doing that work, which we referred to earlier. And quite honestly, these are the guys that I look to as benchmarks, the individuals that Alan works with. Not the only ones, but three of the most significant in the field. So, you know, and again, even the fact that I explained to you today that JFK and Vietnam and the fact that it could have ended in 1965 as opposed to continuing on being, well, gee, now the second longest military engagement in U.S. history, because today, yeah, Afghanistan's the longest. Being that it could have ended much sooner, being that it could have been much less bloody, and it wouldn't have been 58,000 plus dead, and over 1 million men returned back home mutilated, either psychologically or physically, in one way or another. And who
nothing,
knows?
Mm-hmm. Say nothing of in excess of 3 million and probably more of the indigenous peoples of Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam. So, you know, consequential, costly in terms of human lives, on a scale that is very difficult to really come to terms with.
Right. And that was precisely my next point. I always say anywhere between 1 and 4 million, but you're absolutely correct. And quite honestly, I think people never remember that last part of the story there. And I think they often want to forget about the great amount of damage. And one might say, listen, if it is for a just cause, now I don't say this because I, again, view war directly as a, you know, nothing more than a justification for murder in one form or another. But if you were to justify it as being behind a righteous cause of sorts, I fail to find one when it comes to the Vietnam War. So, and again, we've talked about the echoing effects. But, Alan, going forward, before we get deep into the JFK topic, really, there's a lot more to you. that air I started to talk about, the, you know, it's funny. I'm going to break your chops a little bit. You almost come off as if I can imagine you being part of the American royal family, you know, with the way you carry yourself in such an interesting way. It is not because you are arrogant, although some people have said that you sound a bit arrogant. You are confident. You are very confident.
Well, I have reason to be. Go on.
There you go. Yeah. But the thing is, you know, the great sense of humor, a empathetic understanding of the individuals that you're dealing with, a very genuine and like I said, There was a point at which, you know, I approached you late after sitting down and fulfilling my obligation as being a raffle prize at the JFK Lancer.
Oh, man.
Well, that's a true story, right? I mean, I was part of the raffle where the people get tickets and they could spend time uninterrupted with an author or a presenter at the conference. And I was one of those people, and I had sat there and spent an hour and a half with a guy I was supposed to spend a half hour with, because I felt bad because the other guys that he was supposed to get time with seemed to have disappeared. So I just hung out with the guy and had a drink and talked about whatever it is he wanted to talk about until he got bored with me. And afterwards, I approached Alan. And although Alan was sitting among, again, some of these really great people that that are his friends, his associates, his colleagues, he took the time to stand up, turn around, and spend a good few minutes talking to me and going over a few things. I didn't feel very good about the presentation I gave and a couple other things. Very, very genuine and warm guy as well. So, you know, I don't know how to portray that to the people listening tonight or whenever it is you're listening to this. But the thing is, Alan is a very, well, let's see, dynamic individual in the various sort of ways that you could describe him. And again, also one of the most intelligent and thoughtful individuals that I've encountered over time here. And I'm extremely grateful to call myself his friend, which is one of the things that that he said while introducing me at Lancer about me, which I almost felt embarrassed when he said it, because, again, you know, it's just this. It always feels strange when anybody praises me, Alan, honestly. So, but either way, what is it that we should leave people with in the last couple of minutes of this hour? Because next hour, we're going to get deep, deep into the JFK discussion.
I would say that first, I appreciate your courtesies, and I know that the experience of participating in a major conference with company of some senior people of stature had the potential to be overwhelming, but you were composed and you maintained your composure and you gave a thoughtful presentation. You did not misrepresent yourself or your concerns. And, you know, the thing about doing anything for the first time is very much along the lines of the first time that a person flies solo as a pilot. It's the takeoffs and the landings that count the most. You got up in the air, you stayed in the air, and you landed. And nobody died. There was no catastrophe. People applauded in the right places. And so, you know, so good job.
Well, I thank you for that. But I'm looking forward to redeeming myself sometime in the near future when I'm able to get in front of that live audience. Because see, right now I'm talking to the wall and the voice in my head, which happens to be Alan Dale at the moment. And again, at jfkconversations.com, you can listen to Alan giving some very serious interviews that do not touch on the subject that we've covered thus far. Although, well, some of the subject matter is covered there, but very serious, very enlightened, and very interesting interviews that, again, are part of that great audio resource that is being developed by a lot of individuals. You know, I have no problem mentioning that there are a lot of people who have done a lot more work than me so far out there as far as educating the public in general. But Alan Dale, whether you know his name or not, is certainly an integral part of doing that, not only as an assistant to Mr. Lazar, Mr. Blunt, and Mr. Newman, you know, some of them doctors and so on, various degrees that I'm probably, you know, completely not noting here. But these individuals and that circle of individuals, Alan Dale is not only an assistant to them, but belongs in that circle as well. So I look forward to dissecting the current state of affairs in the JFK assassination research field and community in the next hour. And hopefully you guys will stick around and listen to that as well. But we are going to go to a break. And I do appreciate it, Alan, that you are putting up with my sort of Still, by the way, I have kind of an injury to the mouth for my regular listeners. Still got that problem. I had an eye tooth ripped out right before Christmas. So here we are. I'm still dealing with that. The swelling is mostly gone. So now it's just down to my natural stammering and stuttering around while I speak. So there you go. It's my general normal affect now, guys. And I will trip over my tongue as the show goes on. So stay tuned to the Ocelli Effect. Alan Dale and I will be back after this.
Listening to Ocelli.com Radio Network, the alternative's alternative and home of the Ocelli Effect.
First, examine our attitude towards peace itself. Too many of us think it is impossible. Too many think it is unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces cannot control. We need not accept that view. Our problems are man-made, therefore they can be solved by man, and man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. I am not referring to the absolute, infinite concept of universal peace and goodwill, of which some fantasies and fanatics dream. I do not deny the value of hopes and dreams, but we merely invite discouragement and incredulity by making that our only and immediate goal. Let us focus instead on a more practical, more attainable peace, based not on a sudden revolution in human nature, but on a gradual evolution, on a series of concrete actions and effective agreements, which are in the interests of all concerned. There is no single simple key to this peace, no grand or magic formula to be adopted by one or two powers. Genuine peace must be the product of many nations, the sum of many acts. It must be dynamic, not static, changing to meet the challenge of each new generation. For peace is a process, a way of solving problems. With such a peace, there will still be quarrels and conflicting interests, as there are within families and nations. World peace, like community peace, does not require that each man love his neighbor. It requires only that they live together in mutual tolerance, submitting their disputes to a just and peaceful settlement. And history teaches us that enmities between nations, as between individuals, do not last forever.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. The brilliant author of The War State brings you exclusive reports about the big changes upcoming in the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now here at Ocelli.com. Do appreciate you if you're picking this up and just listening to the podcast later on. There are various facilities that carry it, and you are equally welcome to the show. Alan Dale is with me tonight. And Alan, you know, you got to have caught the first hour. If you didn't, then, well, you might not know so much about him. I don't often hear these personal conversations with Alan, so I think we've done something a little different in the first hour than you usually get to hear from him, and I'm extremely grateful to have him along for the second hour. Now, we are going to have to get into the subject of JFK exclusively in this hour, and I think you're going to hear, again, something entirely unique. So, Alan, are we ready to go?
I'm as ready as I'm going to be.
Well, for Alan Dale to say that, that means he's about twice as ready as I am. So here we go. There was a recent article, and by recent, I do mean within the last 24 hours, that was published. And the title of it is, "With More to Come, New JFK Documents Offer Fresh Leads 54 Years Later." Now, Alan, we found out during the break that Alan might have read the same article I did. And, I will get into some excerpts, but should we give them any spoilers here as we go forward, Alan?
The fact that that we are not at this particular moment dealing with the hysteria that was generated on a couple of occasions within the last several months, since late June, pertaining to the release of the materials relevant to the 1992 President John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act, and that someone takes it upon himself, in this case, a journalist named Kevin G. Hall, working for the McClatchy organization, wants to focus on this stuff. I think that is not a bad thing, probably. And I considered it notable that in the
first paragraph of this particular article, which was published on reader-supported news, I think, within the last couple hours, like you said, within the last 24 hours, he refers to the alleged gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald, which stands in noteworthy contrast to the talking heads that were imposed upon us during the great period of hysteria earlier this year.
Well, you know, that is entirely true. And I find it interesting the way the media has shifted its posture regarding how they cover this. Now, what was going on at the time that you and I were headed to Lancer was a whole different animal. You know, obviously the Trump tweeting out there. I said the Trump tweeting out there that, you know, hey, I'm going to release all the files and here they are. And the controversy or whatever it is, because, you know, our friends in England don't say it the same way you and I do. controversy is how we would say it over what files were actually being released, what had already been released, what was the significance of it. We were deluged with all sorts of things, including, you know, Hitler was still alive in the 1950s. right. Gee, here's the one sentence you need to read and all of that. And meanwhile, quite honestly, much ado about nothing in a lot of that. However, there was a lot of interesting information that came out. I find the dynamic in this article, which, by the way, I'll drop the link in the live chat room at Ocelli.com if you guys want to follow along and catch up on the excerpts from which I am going to be reading or mentioning things from. So there we go. It's there now. But it's kind of fascinating the way these stories are presented nowadays. Now, I see the three acts in the scripted arc here. You have the mainstream representation. I mean, listen, this case has already been solved. Oswald already did it. That's that. Now, they do say alleged gunman, and that is progress, Alan. True. But then we also are greeted with, well, here's Zach Shelton. Here's Wim Dankbar. Here's James Files, who was released earlier this year. Kind of curious that that's who they turned to for quotations in this article. But also, our friend Mr. Sabato, which you mentioned in the first hour, is also mentioned in here. Kind of surprised.
He's very popular. He's in Phil Shannon. They're very popular. They must be authoritative.
Well, yeah, it seems that way. I'm almost surprised we don't see our friend who wrote Case Closed. What was his name again? Oh, yeah, Posner, being quoted in this article as well. But fairly even-handed for a mainstream piece, I think. Okay, so one of the first things here that is mentioned in the article after the general, you know, summation, right? Standard journalism, what do? You give the who, what, when, where, why, and how in the first paragraph. Okay, so that happens, and then there's a subparagraph, fine. Then a subheading stating Dallas Mayer was CIA asset.
Yep.
Well, you know, I find it fascinating that this is a news story printed, you know, again, within the last 24 hours, when meanwhile, I mean, we were discussing this and already having sort of seeing this as old news ourselves.
Late,
well, gee.
June.
Yeah. Okay. Just to read from it really quickly. One particular document from the August release, all right, has created much buzz. It, let's see, it that shows, okay, that's interesting right there. Anyway. Shows that Earl Cabell, mayor of Dallas at the time of the November 22nd, 1963 shooting, became a CIA asset in late 1956. Okay. The CIA had withheld the information on grounds that it was not considered relevant. No related documents have been released, but even alone, it's important. Cabell's brother Charles was deputy director of the CIA until he was fired by Kennedy in January 1962. All right, I will stop there from the article. But first of all, if I remember correctly, Charles Cabell was asked to tender a resignation. He was not directly fired. So that's a minor misrepresentation, but one that is often made, I think. I could be wrong there, Alan. But anyway, back to it. I find it interesting, again, that I was confronted with the Cabell Federal Building when I was leaving Dallas, a block away from the Greyhound station. Seems as though this secret might have been known by others for a long time. And many people had postulated that there was a connection here anyway, because, again, Charles Cabell and Earl Cabell were brothers anyway. So why not? I mean, the Dulleses seem to work hand in hand pretty well. Hey, what are your thoughts on this?
I like the idea that right literally before you get on your bus to make the arduous journey home, you're reminded where you are, that Dallas says, okay, brother, don't forget where you are. And here's a big edifice named after this person that perhaps some people who are more knowledgeable than I might find something admirable about, but I certainly have not. The issue, there are a couple of things in the air right now. One has to do with this particular article. The young man, I assume he's a young man, who chose to produce it. It's not the article that I would have preferred. He focuses, as you pointed out, on a couple of people and a couple of things which I think are not credible. And that's too bad, but it's not necessarily the guy's fault. I mean, some people would say, well, maybe the guy is here to introduce certain people. I mean, I'm happy to note that not every dubious name associated with the current state of the JFK research, realm was referred to. So I consider that to be good news, that there was no one pretending to be something she's not mentioned there. If anything, maybe it's a slight wake-up call to us to reach out to journalists and to say, hey, here's the good stuff that we can share with you, and that if you're going to do a piece as we continue to deal with the period of 6 months where these materials are being reviewed and where an ultimate decision will be announced by sometime in April of this coming year. In the meantime, here are some areas where we're standing on solid ground, and the type of progress that is relevant to your story about the release of JFK assassination-related materials may benefit by being aware of things that serious and disciplined scholars who are not trying to sell a book and are not trying to promote a conference in Washington, D.C., and are not trying to do anything except fill in some important blanks, which our very serious scrutiny of the millions of pages to which we already have access and which are being dealt with to a greater or lesser extent by a lot, or at least some serious people, we have the potential for discovery with these new materials as they relate to what we already have. The problem is, someone like this young man responsible for this article, he may not have had the time, the necessary years, or the necessary influence of someone sufficiently knowledgeable to say, what we're looking for will help fill in pieces of puzzles that we've already been engaged with since the early 90s. An inaccuracy to which you referred in that excerpt is that it was not the CIA that decided that the revelation about Earl Cabell as a documented CIA asset starting in 1956, that wasn't the agency that decided it was not believed relevant. That was the Assassination Records Review Board, who had that information in the early 90s. And as Judge Thunheim admitted to me in March of this past year, if they knew then what we know now, there are lots of things which he believes would have been given a different sort of classification.
Well, absolutely. And let me speak to a couple of the things that you just mentioned. First of all, I do believe that it has been a lack of, I don't know whether to call it ingenuity or foresight on the, here I am, I'm going to criticize some people. Sadly, I think that we have not been active enough in reaching out to as many corridors of the journalistic mansion as possible, okay, to get our stories across. Now, the next excerpt that I'm going to read from, literally, I believe, arrived in this article because somebody has made that effort. And unfortunately, it's not always the best people that have imagined that this would be a good idea and have made themselves readily available, okay, yeah, for the purposes of, well, gee, I need to contrast this with something that's available. And sadly, you know, when the National Enquirer is looking for stories, they end up with, well, who is available? And so does a journalist who is probably, you know, I'm guessing here, just simply looking for something to add so that there is more than one side being presented as part of the article. Who are they going to grab? The people that are available. And I think that there needs to be a bit of consideration given to interacting with all levels of media platforms that are available, because otherwise we're going to get buried. Those of us who are very serious about this are going to get buried by those who are just enthusiastic about pushing a brand or a set of products which revolves around, well, a particular narrative or two or 10, depending on who we're talking about, yeah, that they wish to sell. And with that in mind, I go to the next excerpt, which is a quote, and then I'll turn it back to you. That shows why Dallas was the place. This is in quotes. Said Zach Shelton, a retired veteran FBI agent who fervently disbelieves that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone gunman. Okay, I'll pull away from the article for a second. That is the point as to why Shelton is relevant to this journalist, because he is in opposition to the official story. As far as sentimentality or anything else, people will draw a lot of conclusions about this. But I am willing to go on the benign side of this and just say that this is an individual who probably said, this is a guy who has a completely different take on it and appears to have some of the credentials that mean that I should take him seriously about it. He's a former FBI agent.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. Okay. The thing that I think that there are legitimate factors to help explain. Are you still with me?
Oh, what? I'm here. I just muted to stay out of your way there.
No. You're fine. I just didn't hear anything. I thought probably that, you know, I was experiencing some sort of intervention by the guys in the van parked down the street. I think that there are some. Let me start all over again. It was a learning experience for me during this period of this brief but frantic period of excitement, where internationally media outlets, news services, senior segment producers from all over the world were contacting us and requesting interviews and requesting statements and things like that. And Chuck, I don't want to eat up. I realize the clock is really flying with you. There were a couple of things that I wanted to share with you that I haven't discussed with anyone else. But the thing that I would want to describe to you is my rather surprising realization that people who are not into this stuff, and through no fault of their own, I'm not ever going to say, well, you know, the choices that other or that I have made or the serendipity or circumstances of my life should be followed by anyone else who has their own story and their own concerns. But for people who are not much concerned about these issues, specifically about the assassination and more
broadly how that story and studying that story teaches us things that are relevant to understanding how we got to Donald Trump. People who wonder what on earth has happened in the United States, as if Donald Trump had something to do with that. He is a beneficiary of some awfully peculiar developments in the history of the world. And my inevitable position about this is studying the period of President Kennedy's life is relevant to understanding the consequences of his death. And all of that is relevant to how we find ourselves in the predicament we find ourselves in today. I met with and spoke on the telephone with people from all over the world, educated, serious people, many of whom, not all, but a majority of whom seemed to know nothing whatsoever, nothing at all about the story between September of 1964 and the proverbial release date of October 26, 2017, literally as if nothing had happened, nothing at all, that there was no nothing of consequence, that the that none of the I could rattle them all off to you and it would just be ridiculous. How much work has gone because the United States has the potential to be an extraordinary free society and with congressional investigators making a sincere effort to try to come to terms with what on earth is the CIA? What were they doing during the period of great interest to us associated with Cold War conflicts? What are the necessary considerations about how the United States seems to have learned nothing whatsoever from the experience of France in Indochina? And who was JFK? For real, who was he? Instead of, you know, suggesting, well, you know, we all know this or that about Marilyn Monroe, which, of course, unless you're there, I think is subject to dispute or perhaps even reevaluation.
Or even interpretation.
Exactly right. That is a very true thing. And people who know nothing whatsoever about what kind of empathetic and sensitive soul Robert Kennedy was in particular might be in for a rude awakening about the truth about things relevant to allegations about his interest in her. But in any sensitivity to other people's pain is something that that guy embodied about as much as anyone I've ever encountered in my life. But that's not relevant to what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is the fact that we were confronted by this question. What can you tell me about these new release dates and these new materials? And what's it show? And when you have someone, as you quite properly and effectively recommended that the word context is important, when you're talking to adults who have a concern about a particular program that for all I know is on that night, and they're trying to put something together that makes sense, and they want you to give them a quote. They want to refer to you, and they want to be able to use a quick and brief and succinct quote. Where do you begin? It takes a hell of a lot to shut me down. It takes a hell of a lot to make me give such pause before I speak that I cannot think of how to begin to address something. If they know nothing whatsoever about the revelations of the Pike Committee, of the Church Committee, the politics of the Rockefeller Commission, all as precursors to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and they've never even heard of the Assassination Records Review Board, where do you begin if you're asked to give them an expert's sort of perspective on the release of these materials?
Right. This is what I was confronted with, as I believe I told you, in Dallas, doing interviews leading up to the conference. I wanted to promote it. And certainly that was the main question. What do the new documents show? Give it to me now. And, you know, it was like, well, I've got to place this in context, guys. And, you know, and it should not be lost on anybody, by the way. I told Jefferson Morley this personally, but when they started pulling guys like Mr. Posner out of the mothballs, to bring him on to, you know, mainstream media here in America to discuss this the day of and the day after. It was a group of friends and myself who absolutely slammed CNN's Atlanta headquarters with communications pretty much demanding that they go get Jefferson Morley. Okay, to give a counter viewpoint to what we had just seen emerge on their live stream. Okay, but and this is something that I feel no shame about admitting that I did purposely. Okay, and it was necessary. And lo and behold, they went and got him. So so I'm pretty grateful for that. But it is exceedingly difficult to go, okay, 60 seconds, tell me what's new. Well, that's impossible considering I don't know what it is you know. And this is the thing, you know, last night I had Larry Hancock and Carmine on here, and you know what we were discussing? The church committee. Okay? That was laying groundwork for something that I'm telling you right now, even the people that search this out on the internet today and describe themselves as individuals who know something about this case, have a theory in mind, believe that they understand it and everything else, are dumbfounded by that phrase, the church committee. What's that? It is not an essential focused investigation on the Kennedy assassination, and they've never heard of it. And again, they don't even necessarily know that there was something after the Warren Commission in the 1970s that did focus.
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you. That's what I'm telling you. So it might be the wise thing. I'm going to suggest something that certainly occurs to me. I'm not claiming that I'm embracing this as an appropriate posture to take, but it may be that we really cannot do anything about the times in which we live and the weight of the national security state in relation to efforts which would be seen as not exactly ideal from the perspective of the entrenched sort of bureaucratic authority that everybody in every successive generation had to deal with. But I think that whatever you think of the national media, the mainstream media, what Professor Scott refers to as the governing media, there should be no question that we really are outgunned. We're really outnumbered. So rather than arguing with people or making an effort to compete on an unfair playing ground, it may be that the thing for us to do is to document as much as we can the programming that you're choosing to do, the choices that you make about the people with whom you speak and the topics that you cover. Certainly, I feel that the choices that I make about the people with whom I speak, I've got more documentation pertaining to our friend Malcolm Blunt than anyone else has ever compiled. We're working on things all the time, and we're covering the kinds of things that will be relevant to serious students and serious scholars in the future. And I'm not saying to give up by any means, but I'm saying that whatever they can do to us right now, if we do a good job about relating these new releases to the stuff that we already have and to see how those pieces fit together so that we define a more accurate representation of the big picture. It's, as I've said on innumerable occasions, it is cartography to me. It's map making, but the map is not the terrain. It's a representation. And the kind of work that we're trying to do that is aided by having access to materials, by the way, significant parts of which we have not seen yet with all the excitement and, you know, fanatical whatever about this stuff. I can tell you that my friend Dan Alcorn is a brilliant attorney and one of the people who works most closely with Jim Lazar. If you'll allow me just a couple of seconds, I've got about four sentences from Dan about where we are right this moment. And it's relevant to this question about how to deal with communicating to people what we're doing and how it relates to what we've already
learned and what we're already coping with in terms of millions and millions of pages. This was something that I put up just today, and it's from Dan Alcorn. It says, the National Archives has finished processing the records about the JFK assassination that government agencies allowed to be released to the public without objection. However, there are thousands of records that remain withheld in whole or in part, which contain the most sensitive government information about the JFK assassination that agencies were not willing to release in the initial processing. President Trump promised that all of these withholdings will be subject to another review within 6 months. Now it's within really 4 months, to make sure that only very limited information is withheld, information related to live sources. The Trump review remains to be done. For that reason, the most sensitive information about the assassination has yet to be released. The news article that follows is based on what agencies allowed to be released this fall without objection. And that refers to the article that you introduced from earlier, actually late yesterday. With more to come, new JFK documents offer fresh leads after 54 years later.
Right. Well, you know, I recognize that you said earlier there that, you know, we are outgunned, but that does not mean that thinking about this, you know, in an Old West sort of way, it doesn't mean that I don't want to make sure that we have the very best gunslingers available to face the Army. And that is why I am more than happy to have the conversations that we have and to preserve these conversations, these pieces of information and these pieces of the map, if you will, you know, my way. But I also do not believe for a moment that we should abandon the battle, even though the opposition, you know, outnumbers us so drastically.
Yeah. 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 I mean, for this, for all of those of us who love Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai and The Magnificent Seven, I'm not saying that we're not drawn to the fight. We're making the fight. It's our responsibility to fight intelligently. And that's one of the things that I note distinguishes some of the people that I admire the most from others whom, about whom I would not say the same thing. There are people who are just loud and make declarations with no evidence and no process by which serious people can evaluate, you know, claims. But we don't have to focus upon that. If I may, I'd like to introduce a separate kind of area that I'm working on right now with my friend Malcolm Blunt. And this comes really as the result of Malcolm's awareness and Dr. Newman's awareness and Bill Simpich's awareness and Larry Hancock's awareness of the extent to which materials which are technically supposed to exist are absent. And without exaggeration, I can tell you that my own experience with regard to this kind of thing has been eye-opening for me, because long before this year, you know, some of us have spent a lot of time at the National Archives in College Park, where, to give you an example, which is not unique, but it is, I think, relevant to the conversation.
With that, I'm going to drop into the chat room, and also I'm going to include in the podcast a link to an article on the JFK Facts website, which is, I believe, authored by Malcolm Blunt and describes some of this. So go ahead, Al.
Well, I think the article to which you're referring is the one that focuses on a big picture, high-profile example, and that is Volume 5 of the 7 volumes associated with Lee Oswald held within the Office of Security. And Chuck, as much as I love you, I honestly don't feel like I can do justice to the subject of the Office of Security in a confined space. I would say to you that for people who are interested in the complexities associated with the internal systems, the management, and the individual executives with who exercised great authority inside the agency. I would say that studying, obviously, the counterintelligence division, studying Office of Security, security research staff, and the individuals associated with those offices, not all of whom are limited to the period of our great interest in the early to mid-60s. There's a guy named Paul Gaynor, a figure of enormous interest to very serious people, named Bruce Soley, S-O-L-I-E. There's a guy named John or Jack Dempsey. There were a couple of women that had positions of authority, and I'm not referring to Jane Roman, although she was a senior desk officer, but she wasn't somebody involved in anything. There was a guy named Bob Bannerman, and in the 70s, we had a guy in the Office of Security named Robert Gambino. Interesting name. I doubt that he was related to more infamous Gambino from New York.
Well, there's more than one Gambino family, okay?
Exactly right. And it was the materials released through the work of the Assassination Records Review Board where we learned, because we had access to something we'd never seen before, of a memo written by Robert Gambino. It was either a memo or perhaps it was a deposition, for God's sake. I've forgotten it right this second. I've read it 900 times. And that was the source for us of understanding the beginning of something important which would have relevance. See, it might not be assassination related. If we learn from a head, a chief of the Office of Security in the 70s, that the process by which information was disseminated within the agency in October of 1959 involved something, a component called the Office of Mail Logistics, that's news to serious people, and it's the beginning of having the tools that are most valuable, maybe absolutely essential in terms of trying to put together a modest reconstruction of the process by which the Oswald defection scene in Moscow in October of 1959 is dealt with inside the agency. In other words, what does the interior of the agency do when something like the Oswald event takes place? And the answer is, well, it's supposed to do what it does in every other case, like the case of Robert Webster or all kinds of other people who preceded Oswald as people claiming to want to defect to the Soviet Union at the peak of the Cold War.
Right.
But, of course, in the case of the Oswald figure, it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And the point that I always want to emphasize is that it may not be glamorous, and it doesn't tell people a mythology that they want to be true, but it does require a great deal of study, very serious, quiet study. And the result of which may lead to a better understanding about how did the agency function during the Cold War when it was operating the way it was designed to work. And until you know that, you will not have the necessary perspective, have the necessary information to be able to judge what does it look like when something goes sideways or if something is subverted, or in the event to which I referred, where an enormous quantity of material that comes in from other government agencies, primarily the State Department, but not exclusively, do not go where they're supposed to go under normal circumstances in relation to the Oswald event. They are redirected, and they are directed away from the Soviet Russia division, and they're directed to the Office of Security, the Security Research Staff, and Records Integration Division, which is almost an adjunct to CISIG, Counterintelligence Special Investigations Group, where a man named James Angleton rules like a living god. So one of the things that we're interested in right now are all of the references, all of the memos, all of the depositions, all of everything pertaining to the personnel of the Office of Security during the period of our great interest and beyond. Because that's how you fill in missing pieces to puzzles that most people who want Lyndon Johnson to be the ultimate answer to our question are not engaged in trying to deal with. And I'm not putting down people who, you know, I have no information whatsoever to upon which I would draw to say, no, Lyndon Johnson had nothing to do with it. I would never say that. But I would say that, gosh, that's an awfully obvious model that you've concocted there, where you've, whether you're Roger Stone or whomever, and you want us to say, well, if we buy this book, we'll know what happened because the answer is Lyndon Johnson. That's not what the people that I'm working with are interested in doing.
Well, you know, I cannot say that Lyndon Johnson had nothing to do with it, but I do reject the concept that he is the grand architect of all of what went on here. Because what we've learned through the type of work that you've just so eloquently described, again, is that, quite honestly, there is a lot going on here that is not merely under the control of somebody like Lyndon Johnson. He did not have control over the creature that we know today as the CIA.
I like that. Yeah, I'm with you.
And it's just that simple. So if you take a look at their behavior during that time period and all of these interesting leads, not only surrounding the Oswald character, but the behavior of an agency that under any other circumstances would have behaved differently. Okay. We begin to learn a lot of different things. And quite honestly, the reason and part of the thing that I kept snapping to yesterday with Larry and Larry agreed with me is that, you know, you notice how these things sound awfully familiar when you're talking about domestic surveillance and things that had nothing to do with the Kennedy assassination, but all went through the church committee. You notice that the issues are practically the same that we're still confronted with. And why is it? Because these things were not resolved, examined thoroughly, and understood to begin with. You can't even listen. You could be the greatest healer in the world, but if you don't know what disease, okay, because you haven't been able to observe all of the symptoms, or you haven't been able to observe a significant amount of the symptoms to be able to diagnose it properly, how are you going to know whether it's a matter of rest, antibiotics, food, you know, what is the panacea to take care of this? You don't know if you don't know what you're dealing with. I mean, you cannot heal a broken leg with the very same thing that you take care of pneumonia with. It's just that simple. So if we don't know the nature of the disease, we can't cure it.
Well,
and yeah,
you know, I agree. And I think that Larry has a line that I really love, and I love Larry Hancock, and I recommend in particular his book Nexus. I mean, anything he produces is worth being aware of. But Nexus is valuable, I think, as an introduction to the types of areas that I think are very richly and deeply rewarding as a preparation to dealing with the documents themselves. I think having that as a resource will be beneficial. It's called Nexus by Larry Hancock. Larry has a line, and I'm pleased to say that I'll be happy to credit him for saying it. Because after all, imitation is the sincerest form of plagiarism. He says that saying that the CIA did stuff is like saying Washington, D.C. does stuff. and that is really true, because I can't tell you the number of times that I've encountered things that I've brought to Malcolm's attention or things that he has shared with me. And after investing the necessary time and trying to understand exactly what it is, first, you have to understand what it is. That's not something that is necessarily going to happen instantly. And then you have to understand what does it mean. And it might be years, years before you have what you need to be able to put it in proper context. And that is also relevant to our question in this hour. What's going on with these materials, with the types of stuff that's being released, and how are serious scholars dealing with it? I'm tempted to, I don't have to use this kind of language, come to think of it. I was tempted, I'll just allude to it anyway, the way Nixon used to. I'm not going to say this terrible thing I'm about to say. I think it's a characteristic of a very unprofessional approach to this stuff, to decide that you know enough to recognize what a smoking gun is. And really, none of the senior figures that I'm privileged to be in communication with on a daily basis have any expectation that there's going to be something that says, oh, here's what we've always wondered, and we'll be able to communicate this in the fewest number of paragraphs. But what we are doing is we're creating a very detailed representation of everything that happened across a broad geographical spectrum, very deep analysis and identification of every single person on the playing field. And when you get to the point where you recognize that senior figures inside the agency, and I'm not talking about contract agents, I'm talking about people with a lot of experience in different places, where we're dealing with the record, the documentary record, which includes a true name, a field pseudonym, and a file name. So three different names. I could give you innumerable examples of what I'm talking about. Do you got to appreciate we need time to get it right so that we know, you know, what we're talking about, so that we know what we're looking at. And by having the time, which maybe Walt Brown or someone said, the time is our advantage here. I tend at times, and you'll forgive me for just being this, you know, maybe it's an oversimplification, but at times I've represented this as the smartest guys of that era who did this god-awful thing that changed our world and got away with it versus the smartest guys we have right now. And it literally is a battle between right now, whenever right now is, and those guys who got away with the worst thing in the world. You know, and it's going to take a while, but I think I have confidence that already we have more to work with than they would ever have believed, and they would not be enthused.
You know what? I think that is absolutely, again, extremely salient. Exactly. That's the only word that comes to mind as far as an explanation. That is one of the most concise ways to explain exactly where it is we stand. Of course, that's not going to stop people from saying the next time some other documents tumble out or some other piece of evidence allegedly emerges or does indeed emerge one way or another. It's not going to stop people from coming to individuals like you. And believe it or not, they even come to me from all over the world. Sure. Sometimes in the middle of the night, I get a Skype message from Australia. You know, this came out. This is here. Okay, so now tell me this. Who did it? Which is that question that kills me. And when I say who did it, I don't mean who did this specific thing, you know, who actually signed this memo or any. The questions I could probably answer if I examine what it is that they're referring to. No. It's usually like, okay, so tell us who actually did it. Who did the shooting? Short answer. Come on. 60 seconds. Go.
All right.
The problem is, and I've tried to explain it over and over again, that is not the way that this is being done. If you're doing it in a responsible fashion, if you want a short answer, then you're probably going to have had it incubated for a short time period before it came out of that person's mouth.
Well, the short answers can have multiple layers of complexity, but the simple, being guarding against accepting too quickly what you want to be true. That is the thing that you and Carmine and Doug have been engaged in for years, addressing very courageously, I think, challenging these people who want the story to be romantic in the broadest sense of the term. I'm not just alluding to you-know-who. And they want it to be, you know, the good guy version of Oswald, so that they can basically feel like the thing that they kind of just intuitively thought might be true, and certainly the thing that they would want to be true romantically, that now somebody comes along and gives them a tailor-made story that fits their bias. That's what we have to be on guard against. And the other thing that I want to acknowledge is you touched upon, you acknowledged another important realization, and that is that we are skeptical, we're disciplined, we want to be cautious, and we want to be careful. And if we get something wrong, that's progress, because we can correct it, unless we are adamant and determined that, oh, no, we have to stick by everything we've ever said, which, of course, is only stupid. But you make the point, quite properly so, that we want to be able to be in a position to recognize when something comes along that is important. I'm in communication right now with someone that's going to have a book published in, I think, February now or something like that. I'm not certain. And if I understand the basic premise sufficiently well, I can tell you that if the story is as I believe I understand it, it's going to be something that will be valuable for us, not necessarily to be interpreted in exactly the same way as the author. Because as you and I have discussed in the past, sometimes data gatherers are not the most qualified people to be data analysts. But serious, decent, and honorable researchers who present things and make them available so that other serious and decent and honorable researchers whom they respect, and justifiably so, can look at this stuff. That's how you get out of this god-awful internecine Hatfield and McCoy kind of thing that is so stupid and such a preposterous waste of time and money and effort, but time more than anything else. People who focus on stupid things that sound the way they want them to sound without regard to all of the heavy stuff, the heavy lifting that's being done by ultimate, serious, legitimate scholars, that's too much to demand of people who want it handed to them on a silver platter. So I sound more up in arms about it than I really am, and I didn't mean to get all excited, but we want to be open to new things to take into consideration. And that means we're not embracing as a fixed position anything based upon assumption. We will not accept that, as everybody knows, such and such. And the case of Antonio Vesiana is a hell of a good place. And of course, we don't have time to go anywhere near that, which is fine with me. But I want to tell you something before. I know we're about out of time, and I don't want to be too forward because I'm not used to it not being my show. But I defer to you. I want to let you know that your style of addressing this stuff always includes something that is not always in evidence in this realm, and that is you're a sensitive person. Your humanity is in evidence here, and I feel the same about Carmine, and I feel the same about Doug, what's his name, who's our friend in Texas or wherever he is. I don't know
Doug
where
Campbell.
He is actually. Doug Campbell. Is he in Tennessee? I think he's in Tennessee. In any event, you know, you guys are, you know, you're good people, and that's in evidence in how you approach these controversial realms where so many of these little niches, so many of these cliques, so many of these cults or cultists are damned and determined that if you are not with them, you are an adversary. And you guys are really doing what you can in a very humane way to try to dissolve those walls through an intellectual practice. And I think what you're doing is worth supporting, and I'm grateful to you for trying.
Well, I do appreciate that, Alan. Of course, the last thing I'll mention here, because you brought up Lyndon Johnson a couple of times, you know, we can easily say, as you also stated here, that sometimes data gatherers are not the best analysts. You know, it's fascinating to me that we have discovered, I think, through some of that work, that I do not agree with the conclusions of again. But the fact that one of our presidents was, you know, likely a very criminal individual, you know, who was certainly, I use the term greasy all the time because, you know, I got that. Well, I know, but
yeah, go ahead.
Specifically, it's okay. Yeah. Look, they're all great. As far as I'm concerned, remember, Alan, I'm not a left wing guy. I'm not a right wing guy. I don't trust nobody. But the thing is, when you look at a guy like Johnson, we have learned that he is a criminal on multiple levels. We have learned that this was not a guy who you wanted to have a beer with, like George W., who, again, you know, war criminal anyway, in my estimation. But that's another story for another day. The thing is that we certainly did learn the depths at which somebody might go. But to automatically assume that they are guilty of murder based on some piece of evidence that people have alleged and argued over and all these things, this is not what we need to be engaged in. I do believe that it is the kind of work and creating the connective tissue that does make up the majority of the body of evidence here is the important work that needs to continue and needs to be celebrated as often as possible. And unfortunately, I've had to remove some of the pieces of the jigsaw now and then, the jigsaw puzzle, excuse me, that don't necessarily belong in that box.
That's progress.
You know, and that is progress. Whether it is an arduous task or not to do it is, well, for the judgment of the individual involved in it. But I believe it's extremely worthy and something that I'm not going to stop doing until, you know, until I stop doing everything else. So that is where I leave it. Of course, JFK Conversations is where I would like people to begin to go look for Alan and his work. But obviously, as we've discussed earlier, his work will be felt in a lot of other people's works as well. And I want to thank you again for taking this time with us. And I think that this was a unique discussion, if nothing else. So, you know, and a lot of great points were made. I turn over the last 2 minutes here to you.
I'm grateful to you. I enjoy speaking with you always. And there's not enough money in the world to get me to say something like that that I don't mean. I can tell you that one of the privileges that I enjoy as the director of the Assassination Archives and Research Center is I'm responsible for administration and content on our website, which is AARC, as in Assassination Archives and Research Center, AARClibrary.org. We're doing a lot of good things there, including some unique contributions from Dr. Newman, from Dan Hardway, from Dan Alcorn, from Professor David Rohn, and from Malcolm Blunt. And there are particular places in the menu that I would like to refer. One is relevant to our interest in these new materials. It's called Documents and Dossiers. There's an essential page on the menu called Cold War Context, which includes a expurgated but relevant access to the Doolittle Report, what was actually the Hoover Report, which is a blueprint for America as a Cold Warrior state in the early 50s, produced at President Eisenhower's request, evaluating the agency. There's a publication spotlight page, which I update. I update all of this stuff, you know, periodically, and analysis and opinion, where you'll find some valuable things from Malcolm Blunt. And also there's one that we are interested in called Nooks and Crannies, which are just the equivalent of a 3x5 card with something interesting on it. And I'm also responsible for administration and content at Dr. Newman's website, which is jmnjfk.com. And I'm grateful to you for allowing me the privilege of sharing all of that with you and your audience.
Right. And of course, the Assassination Archives and Research Center is something you can often find in the links related to this show when we're discussing the Kennedy assassination. Matter of fact, last night, again, the Church Committee, I sent them to the AARC site to go ahead and take a look at those documents. But of course, there's a lot more there. As a matter of fact, I even lifted a part of the quote and credited the AARC site with the phrasing that described, okay, the church committee in its entirety, because it was just too perfect not to grab and also give credit to. Anyway, Alan Dale has been my guest tonight. I hope you guys enjoyed it. It is certainly a privilege for me to speak to Alan anytime, but hopefully you guys, you know, gained a bit of knowledge and a new perspective on a couple of different issues with this discussion. Remember, I am Ocelli. You guys are the effect, and I hope, no matter what, no matter where you are or who you are, that you are well. Have a good night.